Well, tonight we are in 1 Samuel chapter 25. I am eager to get back to this section because we are in the midst of a unit in 1 Samuel that, as I suggested a couple of weeks ago, needs to be studied and considered together. So 1 Samuel chapters 24, 25, and 26 are very clearly a literary unit. They use a literary device known as inclusio, but we could use a simpler description of this. We could just call it a sandwich. And you know, what makes a sandwich is whatever is in the middle, right? So when I think about sandwiches, I think about my favorite sandwiches, which are Oreo sandwiches. And what makes an Oreo a sandwich is that cream filling in the middle, right? You have two outer pieces of bread or cookie, and then you have the good part inside. Well, chapter 25 is the part inside. It's the part that makes the sandwich a sandwich. And in fact, it oftentimes in biblical literature, it's the centerpiece of the section that really gives meaning and explanation to the section as a whole. And certainly in terms of application and practical applications of this unit, we find a lot of that here in chapter 25. There is another thematic section that we're in, though, that I've mentioned before I want to just touch on again briefly. And that is, if we back all the way up to chapter 23, we find that in chapter 23, 24, 25, and 26, we have four consecutive chapters that all have in common a secondary theme of God's providence, and specifically how people attempt to interpret the providence of God at any given moment, and usually when they attempt to do so, they do so wrong. They do so incorrectly. And we have a contrast in these four chapters between those who seek to interpret God's providence in the moment, on the fly, as it were, as opposed to those who depend instead upon objective revelation. And in each of these four chapters, those who attempt to interpret providence on the fly, in the moment, do so incorrectly, and those who rely on objective revelation, they prove to actually be the ones who have wisdom in those particular encounters. So that's just a reminder of that theme because it's going to be important in our study this evening. Now remember in chapter 24, David has an opportunity as he is in the cave and Saul and his men are seeking to find David and his men in order to arrest them and to kill David. David has an opportunity to kill Saul quietly, quickly, privately in the cave there, and he does not do so. His men are eager for him to do so, and we suggested that there is every rationale that could have been given. You could justify this on any number of bases. You could say this is an act of self-defense. You could say this is an act of divine judgment. God has rejected Saul. He is under God's wrath and condemnation. You could say that David is the rightful king of Israel, and all of those things would be true. And yet David understands correctly that it would be wrong for him to raise his hand against Saul because Saul is the anointed king of Israel. And in David's words, when God is ready to take him out, he will take him out. I am not going to lift my hand. We're going to see a repetition of that in chapter 26. What's interesting is that in chapter 25, the shoe is on the other foot. In this sense, David, in chapter 25, is personally offended by a man who is not an immediate physical threat to him. And yet David finds himself blinded by anger and self-righteousness and is filled with a murderous rage and is spared from that only by the quick and wise intervention of a godly woman. So this is the story of David and Abigail and her husband Nabal, or Nabal. Right? So let's read that chapter. In chapter 25 of 1 Samuel, beginning at verse 1. Now Samuel died, and all Israel assembled and mourned for him, and they buried him in his house at Ramah. Then David rose and went down to the wilderness of Paran. And there was a man in Maon whose business was in Carmel. The man was very rich. He had 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. He was shearing his sheep in Carmel. Now the name of the man was Nabal, and the name of his wife Abigail. The woman was discerning and beautiful, but the man was harsh and badly behaved. He was a Calebite. David heard in the wilderness that Nabal was shearing his sheep. So David sent 10 young men, and David said to the young men, "Go up to Carmel and go to Nabal and greet him in my name, and thus you shall greet him. Peace be to you, and peace be to your house, and peace be to all that you have. I hear that you have shearers. Now your shepherds have been with us, and we did them no harm, and they missed nothing all the time they were in Carmel. Ask your young men, and they will tell you. Therefore, let my young men find favor in your eyes, for we come on a feast day. Please give whatever you have at hand to your servants and to your son David. When David's young men came, they said all this to Nabal in the name of David, and then they waited. And Nabal answered David's servants, "Who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? There are many servants these days who are breaking away from their masters. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who come from I do not know where?" So David's young men turned away and came back and told him all this. And David said to his men, "Every man strap on his sword." And every man of them strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. And about 400 men went up after David, while 200 remained with the baggage. But one of the young men told Abigail, Nabal's wife, "Behold, David sent messengers out of the wilderness to greet our master, and he railed at them. Yet the men were very good to us, and we suffered no harm, and we did not miss anything when we were in the fields as long as we went with them. They were a wall to us, both by night and by day, all the while we were with them keeping the sheep. Now therefore, know this, and consider what you should do, for harm is determined against our master and against all his house, and he is such a worthless man that one cannot speak to him." Then Abigail made haste and took 200 loaves and 2 skins of wine and 5 sheep already prepared and 5 seas of parched grain and 100 clusters of raisins and 200 cakes of figs and laid them on donkeys. And she said to her young men, "Go on before me. Behold, I come after you." But she did not tell her husband, Nabal. And as she rode on the donkey and came down under cover of the mountain, behold, David and his men came down toward her and she met them. Now David had said, "Surely in vain have I guarded all that this fellow has in the wilderness, so that nothing was missed of all that belonged to him, and he has returned me evil for good. God do so to the enemies of David, and more also, if by morning I leave so much as 1 male of all who belong to him." When Abigail saw David, she hurried and got down from the donkey and fell before David on her face and bowed to the ground. She fell at his feet and said, "On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent. Now then, my Lord, as Yahweh lives and as your soul lives, because Yahweh has restrained you from blood guilt and from saving with your own hand, now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. For Yahweh will surely make my Lord a sure house, because my Lord is fighting the battles of Yahweh, and evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of Yahweh your God. And the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. And when Yahweh has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause or for my Lord working salvation himself. And when Yahweh has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant." And David said to Abigail, "Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning, there had not been left to Nabal so much as 1 male. Then David received from her hand what she had brought him, and he said to her, "Go up in peace to your house. See, I have obeyed your voice, and I have granted your petition." And Abigail came to Nabal, and behold, he was holding a feast in his house like the feast of a king. And Nabal's heart was merry within him, for he was very drunk. So she told him nothing at all until the morning light. In the morning, when the wine had gone out of Nabal, his wife told him these things, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. And about 10 days later, Yahweh struck Nabal, and he died. When David heard that Nabal was dead, he said, "Blessed be Yahweh, who has avenged the insult I received at the hand of Nabal, and has kept back his servant from wrongdoing. Yahweh has returned the evil of Nabal on his own head." Then David sent and spoke to Abigail to take her as his wife. When the servants of David came to Abigail at Carmel, they said to her, "David has sent us to you to take you to him as his wife." And she rose and bowed with her face to the ground and said, "Behold, your handmaid is a servant to wash the feet of the servants of my Lord." And Abigail hurried and rose and mounted a donkey, and her 5 young women attended her. She followed the messengers of David and became his wife. David also took Ahinoam of Jezreel, and both of them became his wives. Saul had given Michal, his daughter, David's wife, to Palti, the son of Laish, who was of Galim. Okay, fascinating story. Fascinating for a lot of different reasons. But what I want to try to do in the time that we have is read this story in its context, because I think it may bring out a layer of significance that sometimes gets overlooked in just kind of the Sunday school treatment of this. Now, at the very beginning of the chapter, you have this historical note about the death of Samuel. And there is no real attention drawn to it, but you should recognize how significant a moment that is. Samuel anoints the first 2 kings of the United Kingdom. He is the bridge character, as it were, the last of the judges and the first of what we refer to as the classical prophets. So he's not the first prophet in that general sense, but he's the first of the classical prophets, because the prophetic period is typically associated with the monarchy. And Samuel straddles these historical periods. His life and his ministry spans generations within Israel and really brings us from the darkness of the judges into the glory, at least the onset of the glory of David's reign. A very great man. It's not the last time he's going to appear in 1 Samuel, though, so we're not quite done with Samuel, even though he's dead. Then we get this story about David and Nabal and Abigail. One of the things you need to recognize, hopefully you've already noticed this in a footnote or we're already familiar with it, Nabal or Nabal is a word or a name that means fool. And you would almost wonder, is he called this in the story for ironic purposes? But actually, Abigail draws attention to this in the narrative. So for whatever reason, his parents gave him this name, maybe for other familial reasons, but it becomes an ironic truth about his character. He exemplifies a biblical fool. Biblically, a fool is someone who is not merely simple-minded, but somebody who will not heed the voice of wisdom. He is characterized by pride, he is characterized by selfishness, and his foolishness is self-destructive. And that is Nabal, right? I mean, he epitomizes that character of the fool that we read about in the book of Proverbs. Now, the first part of the story may seem odd to us, because from a Western standpoint, it almost seems like David is trying to shake Nabal down, right? Nabal is fantastically wealthy. 3,000 sheep and 1,000 goats. I don't even know how you quantify that in terms of wealth in our own society, but this man is fantastically wealthy. One of the things you need to understand about the ancient Near East is that sheep shearing was a time of harvest and celebration. Just as in an agricultural context, the day of harvest, the fall harvest, would be a time of great feasting and celebration for the entire family and the estate. Well, in a similar way, for someone whose main business was livestock and animals, sheep shearing was that kind of a time. It was the time when the hogs are slaughtered, right, and where people are eating the fatted calf and they're enjoying all of the proceeds and the wealth that God has given them over the prior season. Now, this is normally a time when a man would bring together not only his household, but his friends and his neighbors, and the stranger within his gates. This is what the law of Moses would teach the children of Israel to practice during such a time. That on this time, you gather together your friends and your neighbors and the stranger within your gates, and you bless them with that which God has blessed you. Right? That you recognize this wealth is not just for yourself. It's not your own. And so David, knowing that Nabal is shearing his sheep, sends 10 men to him. And again, the form of the approach is unfamiliar to us, but it was very typical of the place and the time that they lived. David sends these men because David and his men, as the story unfolds, we find out, have been with Nabal's sheep herders in the wilderness and have protected them from bandits and from various other dangers. David and his men, just as they have been protecting the sovereign cities of Israel, even at times where Saul was neglecting his responsibilities, just as they had saved the city of Keilah from the Philistines, they have been protecting Nabal's flocks and servants from dangers in the wilderness. And it is appropriate that at sheep shearing, David would expect that Nabal would desire to share some of that wealth with him. Now, one of the things that you have to remember that we've seen mentioned already in several stories and we'll see again before the end of this particular book, it is by now common knowledge that David is the next king of Israel. Everybody knows that, including Saul, including Jonathan. All of the people of Israel and even the Philistines have heard that David has been chosen by Yahweh as the next king. And so there is, in many respects, a twofold obligation that Nabal has with regard to David. On the one hand, it is appropriate, just as a matter of the law, that he would show kindness to a stranger, but especially to a stranger who has himself defended Nabal's wealth and servant in the wilderness. But even beyond that obligation, he ought to support and protect and preserve David as a fugitive because David is Yahweh's choice to be king. And so Nabal has at least this twofold obligation. And instead of honoring this request from David, Nabal insults David in a grotesque manner. And here again, our distance from this culture maybe hinders us a little bit in reading this, because what Nabal says, verse 10, who is David? Who is the son of Jesse? That nobody asks that question at this point. Everybody knows who David is. Everybody knows who the son of Jesse is. He is the hero of Israel. He is the war hero who had saved the people from the Philistines. He is the one who stood on the battlefield and struck down Goliath. Everybody knows this. He is the military commander who has struck down the enemy on the battlefield and saved the nation. Everybody in this nation owes him a debt of gratitude. And Nabal says, who's David? Who is the son of Jesse? Well, there are a lot of servants who are breaking away these days from their master. Shall I take my bread and my water and my meat that I have killed for my shearers and give it to men who have come from I do not know where? Now, there is the problem. Nabal views this as his meat. His meat, his bread, his water, his possessions. The law would say, no, God has given this to you that you might turn around and bless other people. David is clearly not a stranger. This is not some homeless bum who appears at your doorstep. This is Yahweh's anointed king. This is the Savior that God has raised up to save the people from the Philistine army. And this is the man who has actually protected your flocks and your herds so that you can actually have sheep shearing today. And he grossly disrespects David. And when David's men come back and report this, notice the repetition in verse 13. Every man strapped on his sword. Every man strapped on his sword. David also strapped on his sword. It's a very violent, it's a very sudden onset of self-righteous rage. Now, something we need to understand here, Nabal's actions are despicable and indefensible. David is not wrong for being offended by what Nabal said. And how do you know that? You know that because God strikes Nabal dead for what he does here. God judges Nabal for this sin. It is a great and grave offense. But the problem is that our anger, our heart is so polluted and so contaminated by our own sinful nature that even when we are, on paper at least, justified in being angry, we usually mess it up. So here, David has reason, rightly, to be indignant about what Nabal has said and done, and the effect of that on his men who are liable to go without because Nabal is such a scoundrel. And yet even that righteous indignation becomes, in David's heart, an unrighteous and self-righteous, murderous rage. David says, "I have done all of this for nothing. I have protected this man's goods, his livestock, for nothing." Now, what does that sound like? That sounds like self-righteous self-pity. Do we do good so that others might recognize that and reward it? Well, we shouldn't. We should do good simply because it's good, simply because we want to honor God. But David falls into this trap of self-justification. And he is prepared now to take the life of all of Nabal's. David's not only protecting them from bandits, he's protecting Nabal's guys from David's own men. Because remember that some of these men are worthless men, right? Some of these guys that are mercenaries with David right now, they're only with David because it's a convenient opportunity for a job, right? And so some of them are themselves kind of scoundrels. Yeah, that's a good observation. One of the young men comes to Abigail, and this is much to Nabal's shame, but it gives us some sense of how well-known his character is. His servants know what a scoundrel he is. They come to Abigail and say, "You're not going to believe what our master has just done, but it's really bad." Even the servants recognize the danger that they are now in. He says, our master is such a worthless man that one cannot even speak to him. And the servant relates to Abigail who David has been for them. He was a wall to us by night and by day. He has protected us. And our master has just offended him greatly. Now, Abigail immediately jumps into action. The description of the food that she prepares, by the way, is a considerable portion of food. I mean, David's got 600 men in the wilderness, right? 200 loaves, 2 skins of wine. By the way, biblical wine would have been condensed, right? That would be wine that was cooked down and then diluted in water, right? Because otherwise you have just this little bit of wine, 2 skins of wine compared to this mountain of food, right? So 2 skins of wine that would then be rehydrated, 5 seeds of parched grain, 100 clusters of raisins, 200 cakes of figs, puts them on donkeys, tells the men, "Head toward David and don't stop. Don't wait for me, right? I'm coming after you." She knows that if David is like any other man, David is going to be on his way, and he is going to be committed to doing harm to her husband. Verse 23, when she comes, she hurries, gets down from the donkey, falls before David on her face, bows to the ground, and says, "On me." What does intercession look like? It looks like Abigail. Abigail doesn't come and simply say, "You know, my husband is a fool. His name is Fool, and he is a fool." Well, that's true. And she's going to basically say that. But she doesn't just come up and say, "David, I understand why you're angry, and I would be too if I were in your situation." She says, "I have sinned. I did not see your servants. I would have been ready to serve you, and it was my fault. It was my wrong. Let the wrong be on me. Forgive me for this oversight, and do not regard this worthless fellow Nabal. For as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent." And then this is where it gets good. Look at verse 26. "Now then, my Lord." Now pay attention to the different words for Lord that are used here. She's referring to David as her Lord, her master. She's referring to him with respect, but she's also using the covenant name of God, Yahweh. "Now then, my Lord, as Yahweh lives and as your soul lives, because Yahweh has restrained you from what? the way that she describes the sin and the way that David will characterize the sin in just a moment is twofold. What are the two things that she's kept David from doing, that God has kept David from doing? Number one, from the sin of blood guilt, that is taking life without justification. This is murder. This is murder. It's not shedding blood in war. It's not shedding blood in self-defense. It's not some judicial, legal, justified act of execution. This is murder. The sin of blood guilt. And secondly, from saving with your own hand. We're going to come back to that. That's the key to understanding this chapter in context. Right? Those are the two faults. Now then, let your enemies and those who seek to do evil to my Lord be as Nabal. Let them be fools. Let them be disregarded. Let them be cast aside. Right? That's what she's praying. That's basically an imprecatory prayer about her husband. Right? Verse 27. And now let this present that your servant has brought to my Lord be given to the young men who follow my Lord. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. She's not talking about Nabal. She's talking about herself. That's what intercession looks like. Intercession is me stepping between the guilty party and the offended party and saying, I will take their place. This is not Abigail's fault. She hasn't done anything wrong other than just agreeing to marry a fool, right? This is his fault. But she is stepping between. Who's the Christ character in this story? Guess what? It's not David. It's certainly not Nabal. It's Abigail. Do you see the picture of Christ? What is Christ doing for us? He is stepping between the offender and the offended. He is stepping in the place of the fool. Do you think of yourself like Nabal? I bet you imagined that you were David in this story. Right? I mean, who of us reads 1 Samuel 25 and say, boy, I can really relate to that Nabal character? I don't think I've ever thought that reading this chapter. Oh, I can relate to David. Oh, I've been unjustifiably angry. Right? I've been offended when somebody wronged me. Right? I can get into the David character here. But do you realize that in this story, in terms of the gospel connection of this story, you are Nabal. I am Nabal. I'm the fool. And Abigail steps between the fool and the offended, righteous, avenging Lord that's about to rain hell down on his house. That's what Jesus does for us. Please forgive the trespass of your servant. For Yahweh will certainly make my Lord a sure house. Why? Because my Lord is fighting the battles of Yahweh. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. I'd like to just park there for just a moment. We don't have long. She has absolute confidence that God is going to bless and care for David. Do you see that? She has clarity and confidence with regard to God's purpose for David's life that he does not have at this moment. Why? He had it in chapter 24. He has it in chapter 26. But in this moment, David does not have confidence or clarity with regard to God's providence. Why? Because he is blinded by self-righteous rage. He is blinded by selfishness and pride. He is offended. And he's got a right to be offended. He's been truly wronged. But even righteous indignation in a polluted heart becomes self-righteousness. And what Abigail basically says here in verse 28 is, don't lose sight of the big picture. Don't throw away what God is doing in you and through you for the sake of a fool. You see, that's what we do. We lose sight of the will of God for our lives, the purpose of God in our lives, for the sake of a fool, for the sake of a moment of satisfaction, of unrighteous anger, or some other temptation. We throw it all away. Abigail says, God is going to establish your house because you fight God's battles. And evil shall not be found in you so long as you live. We were talking this morning in the men's class about the way in which the devil, in the first 3 centuries of the church's history, tried to stamp out the Christian church by means of violent persecution. You know how well that worked? It didn't. It spread the gospel like wildfire. It made Christianity so pervasive in the Roman Empire that the gospel overcame the Roman Empire rather than the Roman Empire overcoming the gospel. And since that time, what has the devil sought to do to nullify the Christian church? Not stamp it out with violence, but just make the church like the rest of the world. And it has been far more successful. The church today, by comparison, is so weak, so compromised, so corrupt. And why is that? Is it because we're being persecuted? No! It's because we are so comfortable in the world. We find an analogy in Israel's own experience. When the king of Moab calls out Balaam as a prophet of the true God, come and curse my enemies, come and curse the Israelites. Balaam cannot curse them. He can only bless them. Why? Because God does not find evil among Jacob. In the aftermath of that, Balaam, in pursuit of that prize, that purse, that reward that the king had offered him, said, you know, if you could draw this people into sin, then their own God would turn against them. And that's exactly what happened. They fall into sin. They commit idolatry and fornication with the people in the sin of Peor. And God punishes them. God brings judgment on the Israelites. See, Abigail recognizes God is going to bless you. God is going to take care of you. Do you think that your men are going to starve because Nabal doesn't cooperate? Nabal is not bigger than Yahweh. You are fighting Yahweh's battles. Evil is not found in your midst. Don't lose sight of that. But David has, for a moment. Verse 29. If men rise up to pursue you and to seek your life, the life of my Lord shall be bound in the bundle of the living in the care of Yahweh your God. Isn't that a beautiful thought? I mean, you think about a little boy having a handkerchief where he wraps up all of his precious possessions and puts it in his pocket, and you think about God's people being wrapped up in God's handkerchief and kept in his pocket. You will be bound up in the bundle of what those whom God loves. But by contrast, the lives of your enemies he shall sling out as from the hollow of a sling. He'll be thrown away. And when Yahweh has done to my Lord according to all the good that he has spoken concerning you and has appointed you prince over Israel, my Lord shall have no cause of grief or pangs of conscience for having shed blood without cause, or for my Lord working salvation himself. There's your two sins again. And when Yahweh has dealt well with my Lord, then remember your servant. Abigail is looking at the long term. And how often do we do this? How often do we consider our actions in a moment of anger and say, I don't want to say or do something that I'm going to regret later? We don't do it enough. I don't do it. She says, one day God is going to elevate you to exactly the place and position that he has promised to give you. And I don't want you to carry the burden of a defiled conscience because you remember the day that you committed murder. And how does David respond? He praises God. It takes him a little while, actually, to get around to saying thank you to Abigail. Blessed be Yahweh, the God of Israel, who sent you this day to meet me. Can David hear rebuke from a godly woman? Yes, absolutely. He thanks God. He says, it was God who sent Abigail to meet me. Blessed be your discretion, and blessed be you who have kept me this day from blood guilt and from working salvation with my own hand. For as surely as Yahweh, the God of Israel, lives, who has restrained me from hurting you, unless you had hurried and come to meet me, truly by morning there would not have been left to Nabal so much as one male. He's not bragging. He's not boasting. He's confessing. He's admitting, this was my purpose. This was my plan. I was going to wipe everyone out. Thank God that you got here. Now, the end of the story, real quickly, and then I want to circle back and talk about the theme. Abigail comes home. Nabal is drunk. It's a time of feasting. That's what you're supposed to do, right? Eat the fat, drink the sweet. He is riotously drunk. Abigail, showing her discretion, her discernment, doesn't even try and talk to him when he's drunk. He waits until the next morning. He wakes up from his stupor, and she says, "By the way, honey, do you understand what happened yesterday?" She tells him the story, and his heart died within him, and he became as a stone. Now, commentators don't know exactly what happens there. I don't know if this is a figurative expression of him just being struck with the grief and the guilt and the fear of how narrow a miss he really had, how close a call he really had, or whether there is some medical event here. It's interesting because it says about 10 days later, the Lord struck Nabal, but it could be that that is a second strike against Nabal. What you may be seeing is something like a stroke, right?
Exactly.
But regardless, Nabal experiences the terror of this moment. And then 10 days later, and the text is very explicit, God's the one who kills him. Just in case you think that David kind of blew this out of proportion. Oh, David just got his feelings hurt. He was offended because he had too much ego. David sins in this. There's no doubt. But in case you're wondering what God thinks about Nabal, God kills Nabal for this. That's how big a deal it was. To insult God's anointed servant and Savior in this way, big deal. Nabal picks a fight with God. Who is going to defend David? Well, thank God that through Abigail's intervention, David steps back and allows God to defend him. Now let's talk about why this story is here. In chapter 24, the man who is committed to killing David, the man whose entire purpose in life is to destroy David and his family in order to place his own son Jonathan on the throne, that man is within arm's reach of David. David has a knife in his hand. He is able to cut off the corner of Saul's robe without Saul realizing it. Do you know how sharp that knife is? Do you know how good David is? Saul would have been dead before he knew it. He would have never known that David was there. In chapter 26, we're going to see again, God providentially places David and one of his mighty men, his nephew Abishai, standing over a sleeping Saul with a spear stuck in the ground next to Saul's head. And Abishai is going to ask for permission. Let me strike him just once. I won't have to strike him twice. There is every justification that you could imagine for David to allow his men to take Saul out. And David has clarity and confidence with regard to God's will. In both of those stories, David recognizes that it is not his right to raise his hand against Saul. And in chapter 25, he has no clarity, no confidence. He is full of self-righteousness. He is full of pride. He is filled with murderous rage. He does not see reality clearly. It takes Abigail to show him what he knows, what he says in chapter 24, in chapter 26. He knows this, but it's like he forgets it for a moment. In this flash of fury, he forgets that he is not to work salvation with his own hand. That, in my judgment, is the reason the story is here. Three times, Abigail and David acknowledge that the sin would not have just been murder, it would have been working salvation with your own hand. You and I probably look at that. That may not even register on our radar. We say, what's the big deal? I get why it would be wrong to murder Nabal. I get why it would be wrong to murder Nabal's servants. Yeah, that's a terrible thing. That's an overreaction. What's the big deal about working salvation with your own hand? The whole section, the whole unit beyond this chapter is reinforcing what point? God is the one who saves David, not David. David is a mighty man. David is a tremendous warrior. David can go on the battlefield and he can face down giants and he can lead armies against the Philistines and he can win again and again and again. But the one who wins that victory is always God. It's not David. And who is it that fights for David? It's Yahweh. It's Jehovah. David is not there to defend himself. Nabal commits a very great and grave sin. He deserves to die. Whose place is it to kill him? It's God's. It's God's. David has been anointed as the king of Israel. He is not yet sitting on the throne. He is not the magistrate. He is not the man who sentences offenders. And if he killed Nabal under these circumstances, it would have been murder. Because he's not authorized to do it. Now, the application should be kind of obvious, I think, right? That we are to entrust ourselves and our suffering to the one who judges justly. We are to do that as Jesus did. I'm going to turn over in the New Testament real quickly to 1 Peter chapter 2. I want to just give you a kind of a touch point here in terms of application. 1 Peter chapter 2, verse 18. Peter is addressing Christians who are suffering unjustly. He's not endorsing the injustice that they are receiving from the hands of their masters. He's just acknowledging the reality that we live in a world where we're going to get treated unfairly. We're going to get used and abused by other people. And how are we supposed to handle that? How are we supposed to deal with that? Well, listen to what Peter says. Verse 18. Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when, mindful of God, one endures sorrows while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if, when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. For to this you have been called. Because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. He himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. He continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. That's what David forgets to do in this chapter. And by God's grace, through Abigail's influence, that's the lesson that he learns. We are so quick to talk about when we are justified in defending ourselves. I believe you're justified in defending yourself. I believe that if a man climbs into your bedroom window in the middle of the night, that the law of God gives you the right to take a weapon and protect yourself and your family. I believe that. But you know, we are so quick to talk about when we are justified in defending ourselves that we forget about this principle of non-retaliation. We forget about this principle of not taking vengeance for ourselves. We forget about this principle of entrusting ourselves to the one who judges justly. We are conditioned by our society to look out for ourselves, to protect our rights. And it's natural that we do so, but it's not spiritual. In this chapter, we see the man who has been the Christ character not playing the role of Christ. He loses clarity with regard to God's will and purpose. And he decides, I can take vengeance into my own hands. I can right this wrong. Saul may be protected by the anointing oil of God. Nabal certainly is not protected. But here's the reality. Nabal is an image bearer of God. David does not have the right to take his life in this context. If Nabal needs to be taken out, God will take him out. And God does. But the sin would not have only been murder. It would have been trying to save himself. And that's what the people of God are not supposed to do. We are supposed to trust the one who is our Savior and entrust ourselves to Him. And just like David, I think there are times in our life where we can see that with so much clarity. And then there are times in our life, whether because of our pride, our selfishness, a moment of anger, whatever it may be, we have this massive blind spot. This is not a fine moment for David, but it is a beautiful moment for Abigail. What makes her beautiful in this story? She is apparently a beautiful woman, but what makes her beautiful is that she is a woman of wisdom. A woman of wisdom. And she is to be praised. She is to be preferred. And God greatly honors her in this story.